Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Carulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Oh yeah, Wake Up Hollywood. This is your host with the most, Nikki Carulla. I'm here also with Ronan Rosener. Hey, what's up, Ronan? Hey. How are you, man?
Good. It's been a while.
I know. It's been too long. How are you?
I'm doing great.
I like that you're behind the scenes, but sometimes you're like, you know what? Right. I will step in front of the curtain.
Yeah.
I like that.
Especially with tonight's topic. I'm like, oof.
You're like cars. We're going to jump right into this interview because we have an amazing guest, Bassem Wassef, who's been doing journalistic articles for Automotive Magazine, Men's Journal. You've written 3 books on cars.
Indeed, and motorcycles, yep.
And motorcycles, that's right. That's right. I didn't know you rode motorcycles.
I'm a fiend for motorcycles. And the funny thing is that cars take up a lot of my work, a lot of my hours, but there was nothing like a good bike. Like, riding a good bike is a totally different experience.
I agree.
We could talk about that, but it's...
What's your favorite bike?
Ah, man, where to begin? I love Italian bikes because you don't ride because you need to, really.
Right.
At least here in the States, you don't. You ride because you want to, and it's really all about the passion. It's not about transportation. It's not about practicality. It's about getting excited about the process of just moving through space. And I think the Italians do it best. So MV Agusta and Ducati and bikes like that are just such an experience.
The fast rocket bikes.
It's funny because when I was really little, I loved the idea of riding a superbike and just being like, you know, stretched out over the bike and extreme, you know, uncomfortable. And I didn't actually really get to ride until I was a little older, which probably saved my life in a way.
When did you start? In your 20s, 30s?
Okay, so I always rode my friends' motorcycles when I was a kid. Like growing up, a buddy of mine had a little Honda Monkey, like a little mini bike. And then, I snuck a scooter around in college. My parents didn't know about it because they're both paranoid and they didn't want me to get hurt.
Right.
I rode my friend's sport bikes, and I loved sport bikes, but I didn't get licensed until I was about to turn 30, legally. So, I waited really long.
You're like, I'm going to make sure I really want this.
No. I knew I wanted it. And I was riding, but it wasn't always like off-road and kind of like, but I realized I was about to turn 30. I was like, if I don't do this now, I'm never going to get get legit about this.
My dad rode a Triumph.
I love Triumphs.
That was his favorite bike.
A buddy of mine just got a Triumph, and I was just texting him saying how jealous I was. He got a Thruxton R. So, I got licensed, and then I went off the deep end, man. I went deep into it. I was learning on racetracks from pros and, you know, adventure riding off-road.
So, like, you would ride and do the little, you know, like, 1 inch off the, like, off the track with your knee?
I got there.
Wow.
I wasn't there when I started, but
wow,
the more you do it, the better you get. And it's a gradual. It's like learning to walk. It's like you can't just go full bore out of the gate. You got to really kind of step by step figure out what the technique is.
That's a rush,
And the great thing is that when you do it with pros, they've been there, done that. They tell you exactly what you're doing wrong, which is what you need to hear. If you don't hear that, you live in this vacuum of thinking that you're really fast.
Right.
But then you see footage of yourself.
And you're like, oh my god,
I barely leaned over.
Right,
oh yeah. Yeah, I was dragging my elbow. No, you weren't.
You take your elbow out, you're leaning into the corner, but the bike is like
exactly.
And you're like, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And then the sliders is like, oh, what?
And you learn a lot about your body too, right? Like, you don't realize this, but you know, when you look at the footage, you see the telemetry, you get off the track, you look at the fact that you scraped off your knee puck on the right, but you didn't touch the left.
Exactly.
You're like, oh, I'm totally imbalanced. Like, I'm not doing this right. So there's a lot of layers to it. And that's what I love, is getting deep into the technique and learning things that, you know, you didn't know You didn't know you didn't know. And it's like an onion. You keep going deeper and deeper and deeper. And then that's what gives you even more respect and awe for the guys who are like at the MotoGP level.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like they called them aliens. There's like, you know, three riders in the world that can ride at that level. It's so intense. And it's so technical. It's fascinating.
And just like a split second can make the difference of you getting hurt or
making it.
You know what I mean?
And when it goes bad, it can go really bad. But they're sliding the front tires. They're sliding the back tires. They're doing things at such an advanced level. It's amazing to watch.
And how did you get into the Italian bikes?
They spoke to me. Yeah. It's like all things mechanical. Like, you know this, right?
Yeah.
Like all things mechanical, some things you get along with and some things you don't. It's a lot like people.
Right.
It's chemistry.
Yes.
And it's like this, you're interacting with this thing and it sounds dumb because it's an inanimate object, but it comes to life. It makes these sounds, it makes these feelings, it gives you feedback. Sometimes it doesn't. And it's like this ongoing connection that you have and you're trying to figure it out. And, you know, it's a lot like riding a horse. It's like,
well, it's also like you're a fan of engineering.
Yeah.
You're a fan of things that are crafted well. So when you see something that is just made well,
yeah,
you become a fan of it too. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then when you can actually use it and ride it and feel, you know, every little nuance of it, that's when it takes on.
Yeah, it goes hand in hand. I don't think you can be a motor enthusiast and not know about the mechanics of it. And a lot of the new cars, there's really nothing you can do. All they put the covers on top of the engine. But if you like classic or motorcycles, then yeah, you get your hands dirty, you know, elbow grease and wrenches and whatnot.
It is really true. The thing about new cars, I love new cars, and they can so much of what old cars couldn't do. But the more I get into new cars, the more I appreciate older stuff.
The older ones.
So we just had a brief mention of your watch, and I have a very similar watch to that, and this is like an older version of, like, this is an old 70s chronograph, because you can't see this if you're on the radio. Old 70s Seiko chronograph, and I love this one, too, because it's almost the imperfections of it that make it interesting.
It's a classic. That's a watch my parents bought me in 1986.
Wow.
When I went to the military service. And originally I was supposed to go to the Navy submarines. So they bought me this Seiko diving watch. And it was like automatic. That was like the best. Mm-hmm. It would cost an arm and a leg. And I kept it ever since. And about a year ago I took it out. Sent it to someone. They polished it, cleaned it. I had some of the, you know, the inner parts replaced. Mm-hmm. That watch will, if you take care of it, last 100 years.
That's amazing.
They're great.
That's just good craftsmanship.
Old school craftsmanship. It's not about replacing it in a couple of years. It's about lasting for a very
long time. Indeed. My buddy Chris Cantle, who edits, he's the editor of Motorcyclist.
Mm-hmm.
His grandfather put together SR-71s in Burbank back in the day, and he had an SKX, a vintage Seiko. And he said, you know what? If it's good enough for him, it's good enough for me. And he has one that is kind of like an homage. You know, I think it's his grandfather's watch, and he also has his own. So cool.
Very cool. All right, so you started writing books. What was the catalyst that made you want to write your first book?
I think the lure of books is the permanence. I write, you know, probably almost every day or every other day for magazines. And I love magazines, and I love the world of magazines. I love picking up a magazine and the experience of that. But the flip side of that is you read a magazine, and then what happens to the physical artifact of the magazine is it usually doesn't stick around, you know? And maybe it's getting older. Maybe it's thinking about things and sort of trying to think longer range, longer term. But there's something about a book that's so physical. You hold it in your hands. It's got weight to it. It's becoming a dying breed. It's becoming a novelty now, which is kind of sad.
It's kind of. I think books are making a comeback. You know,
they're like vinyl records in a way. You
yeah,
know?
Exactly.
True. There's nothing like I never got into the digital book reading.
Mm-hmm.
I never got into it. I like having a hardcover or a softcover book and just going through. I mean, it's an experience.
Yeah. There's something about it.
And the smell, The smell. The feeling of it.
And the counterbalance to the digital world. Like, if your eyes are on a screen all day, I love at the end of the day turning off the phone, picking up a book or a magazine, and letting natural light fall on the thing and just, like, you know, ease your eyes. It's a different experience. And it's like the LP thing. There's a non-linear aspect to it. Or I should say it's actually a linear aspect. You have to go this way,
right?
Flip the pages, go through it. You know, you got to listen track by track, right? It's the same idea.
But that's
versus
that's
the web. You can bounce around in different directions.
And it's like your attention span. You have to be a little bit focused,
to
just get through it. You know what I mean? So the cool thing about you actually writing a book, that's an intense amount of organization and just kind of like, you know, taking one vision and a very eclectic subject, but kind of, you know, focusing that vision into a reality. That's what's amazing about it. So tell us, like, what went into the first book and what inspired the second and the third books.
So first book, Legendary Motorcycles, was about these iconic motorcycles, the motorcycles that became famous for whatever they did in the world. So, you know, the motorcycle from Easy Rider, for instance, like this just like American icon. And doing that involved a lot of travel in the U.S., and it was actually a great opportunity for my wife and I, Anna, to buy an old Porsche 911 on the East Coast.
You poor thing.
What year?
Back when they were affordable.
What year?
It was an 83 911 SC, and I bought it for, it's embarrassingly affordable back then.
Yeah.
And we bought it and drove cross-country and stopped at people's houses and car and motorcycle collections and photographed the bikes and interviewed the people. So
oh,
it was
that's
this,
awesome.
It was this amazing
so
experience.
You knew you wanted to make this the angle.
Yeah, I talked to a publisher. We sorted out, we hashed out kind of like the overarching theme, and we kind of like agreed on the parameters, and then I set out to do this work. And it was a trip. I mean, I met so many legends. I met legends. I met so many heroes. And, you know, I dove deep into their stories. They told me their stories. They shared their lives with me. They shared their motorcycles with me. And I remember pushing, like, for instance, James Dean's very first or very last motorcycle that he owned up a hill, like sweaty in the middle of Indiana, worried about damaging this pristinely restored motorcycle.
Wow.
That James Dean once rode. I mean, it was stuff like that. It was this intimate kind of like experience. It was priceless.
Were there bikes that you could ride and some that you were like, okay, you're not allowed to touch this one?
I didn't ride any of them, and I'm glad I didn't. Like, I handled them and I positioned them for the camera, but that's, I mean, honestly, it's almost more stressful than riding them because, you know, all the things you hear about, like things that happen with motorcycles, are usually between 0 and 5 miles an hour. Bikes want to fall at that speed.
Right.
You don't have the, you know, the rotational inertia to keep it up. So it's like you're worried about slipping or whatever. But it was great.
What was your favorite bike in the first book?
Oh, good question. Really good question. There's so many. I mean, it's a tough
one. You can only take one of those bikes with you to an island.
The Britain V1000.
See, there it is. There it is.
It was.
And why?
It was such an original engineering statement. You know, it was such a out-of-the-box, brilliant expression of something nobody had ever seen before. And it was so shockingly modern for its time, and it's still shockingly modern. It was from John Britain, New Zealander, who died at a young age, but he had this brilliant career, short-lived but brilliant career. Mm. Beautiful bike.
And you think the German engineering versus the Italian, because there's schools. You think geography plays a huge role into how things
Japanese
are kind of like.
Japanese versus German versus,
It's
Italian.
Like people. Yeah, it's like people. You see a reflection of the culture in the machine. I mean, cars were invented in Germany, and you can feel that because the roads are engineered such that you can drive as fast as you want to legally, and the cars actually feel like they're up to the task.
Wow.
And, you know, the world's cars have improved in time. You know, there's a lot of cars that can do that now. They're not the only ones that have the market cornered anymore.
It was like a time period.
It was a time period. It was a culture. It was a sense of, you know, function, a real strong sense of function. I've been partial to German cars pretty much my entire life. I've had old Mercedes-Benzes. I've owned 2 Porsches, currently have one right now. But, you know, the pendulum also swings. I got really into quirky old British off-road vehicles.
I have a
1963 Land Rover Series 2A that I'm bonkers about, and it's about the dumbest, most imperfect industrial
gas
machine
guzzler.
Ever.
It's just a box, like
it's a box
with an engine,
and it's yeah, and it's like a farm implement.
It's like the old safari kind of.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's the kind of if you had to drive one car through Africa. It's the kind of truck that you would want. Maybe you'd probably want something more modern and comfortable, but it's like you could fix it with tools that you can carry in a little case in your hand, you know.
Now, this all started when you were a kid. You were singing to your Matchbox.
Yeah,
cars, right?
It was a lifelong affliction, really. It started early. And it's funny because I have a seven-year-old. My son is... It's interesting to see these things come out and how the human mind works and what we're attracted to. And he is so kind of like scientific and analytically minded, and he watches these YouTube videos about like just like he learns so quickly about
right.
everything, you know, castles, how rockets, he's obsessed with the Apollo space program.
Oh wow.
Architecture, and you know, the funny thing is now he's like tangentially getting into these kind of military things because it's all about engineering, right? Missiles
right.
and submarines and aircraft carriers.
Well, that seemed to be like the necessity to even have the engineering in place.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. But he's like, well, Daddy, is it wrong that I'm interested in these things that hurt people? I'm like, you know what? It depends on how you use it. If it's about what it's made to do from a technical aspect, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean you have to hurt somebody.
A tank can be very interesting.
Oh, yeah.
From
completely.
A mechanical point of view.
Completely.
Engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been to the Peterson Automotive Museum?
Many times. And you know what?
That place.
Not to date myself, but when I was in college, I was a volunteer there when they were just opening up.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I just took my brother there like a year ago, and we did that little VIP tour.
Oh,
like,
nice.
The cars that they show you, like... You know, some with bullet holes from, like, you know, ambassadors or prime ministers that were being shot at, to, you know, Lamborghinis, to just, like, you know, vintage cars. Like, there's so much crazy engineering.
Yeah, the engineering and, you know, like you're saying, like, the culture, right? Like,
right.
how people use this stuff and how it played a part in history and how it folded into, like, the big picture. I think that stuff is great.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So what was your favorite car as a kid when you were playing with your Matchbox cars versus what's your favorite car now?
Okay, so as a kid, I was obsessed with supercars, which is why this book was kind of, Speed Read Supercar was kind of like coming full circle for me. I was the kid in high school who had a Lamborghini Countach poster on
me
well.
Too, man. Me too.
That was it. That was it. But then the McLaren F1 came along and that rocked my world, and it still rocks my world, and it's probably still kind of like my ultimate dream car. So McLaren F1 for me is it.
Wow.
And I've driven a Countach and I haven't driven a McLaren F1. So
how was the Countach? I've only seen one on the
road.
So
I had so many people tell me, do not meet your heroes. It's an awful car. It's a piece of crap.
Right.
And I was so prepared for it that when I drove it, I didn't care. I was like, this is still great.
Yeah,
it's a Countach.
It could be a crap car if you're stuck on the 405 in Los Angeles. But
yeah.
Let's face it, it's like...
It's still awesome.
It is.
It's still awesome.
Still
it's still a 48-valve, massive V12 sitting inches behind your head. I mean, wedge shape, scissor doors, and that alien design. I mean... Really,
right.
You can't.
I love
the
story.
Complain.
You know the story about how Lamborghini became a car company.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an amazing story. Do you know that story?
I think so. That they started manufacturing tractors.
Yeah,
no?
Yeah.
And then he had Ferraris, and so he went up to the, you know, Ferrari guy, and he was like, you know, your clutch really needs. He's like, you stick to tractors. When you can make something better than my Ferrari, then we'll talk. And that's how it was born. It's like. Just like it was all ego.
One disgruntled
car.
Customer
I know,
launched
right?
an empire.
Right. And now they're all those cars are like, you know, they're on back order. All the custom ordered ones are, you know, just crazy. It's
the
so
super
crazy.
Supercar market is kind of insatiable right now.
Well, speaking of supercars, what is your favorite car that you got to kind of explore, investigate, see in person? in your book?
Let me think.
There are a lot of amazing cars in that book.
I mean, going back to the McLaren F1, just the engineering of that car, I was just actually, even after I wrote the book, I was just a couple months ago at McLaren headquarters in Woking, and the XP5 was there. So that was the fifth version of the prototype that ended up hitting 243 miles an hour.
Wow.
Still a record that's held to this day. This is in the 90s, and it's still held to this day for a naturally aspirated production car. And just to be around it was a trip. Mm. Just to be in its presence was special.
That's a V12, did you say?
It is a V12, yeah.
That is crazy. So what's the 0 to 60 in the car like that?
It's in the threes, I believe, low threes. So it's not the fastest car on the planet now, but it's been around for so long, and it has such breadth of capability that's what's really remarkable. And it has, you know, everyone's gone to turbochargers now. This was a naturally aspirated engine. It was the first production carbon fiber tub. Hmm. It took 4,000 man hours to hand assemble that tub. Now it takes about 4 hours to build something like that. So it was painstakingly built. It had gold foil around the engine bay to keep the heat, and there was cost no object. And I was actually really lucky enough to talk to Gordon Murray at the Geneva Motor Show recently, and he was, you know, he was telling me about the experience of how he took one out very early in the morning in Germany with the goal of trying to hit top speed on the Autobahn, wide open Autobahn, and he just didn't have the, you know, cojones to take that
really?
Risk.
Really? I thought Andy, it will run out of road or something.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, well, Andy Wallace, who did the 243-mile-an-hour run in the XP5, was saying that at about 180, it started getting unsettled. And so it starts...
Like you feel
it gets
like it's
light.
Out of control.
It gets light. Wow. But then you go up to about 200, 210, and then it starts to settle back down again. But this is on a closed circuit that was, I think, Aralesson is the track, but it's 5 miles long, straight. There's no road in the world that's that straight for that long. And, you know, imagine reaching 180 and then realizing, okay, it's getting loose, but I'm going to keep going.
Wow.
Yeah, it's insanity.
You have to kind of like, there's no fear.
It's total insanity. Yeah.
There's no fear. You have to cross that
threshold.
Yeah,
I wonder if you're thinking, is it my life that I'm worried about or the crashing that $1 million car? Yeah.
What was the most extravagant thing that, you know, like with these like supercars, there's always something that they do to kind of make it a signature, whether it's like indulgent or it's just absolutely incredible engineering. What was the most ridiculous thing that you found in any of these cars?
Just some of the attention to detail. I mean, some of the things that the supercar manufacturers do, like the way that Horatio Pagani will match the carbon fiber weave on the seams of the bodies of the car so that it's like a herringbone suit. Like it's put together so beautifully. I mean, the great thing about supercars is they go so deep into so many different areas to reach the extraordinary. There's no reason a car has to look like that or do that for transportation. Right. But this isn't transportation. It's verging on art.
It's sport.
Yeah.
It really is like art and sport kind of combining.
Totally. And the amount of technology that goes into these things. I mean, you know, you've got technology trickling down from Formula One, where cost is really no object. I mean, there's hundreds of millions of dollars that are spent, and they try to put caps on it, but, you know, they do all these crazy things and take so many talented people to make these things happen. This infinitesimal obsession with little things that, if they're done wrong, they can destroy the whole thing. Like, my second book was Legendary Race Cars. And the STP turbine car was basically a jet-powered race car that got banned before the season was even over. But it was so close to winning the Indy 500, but a $2 part busted, and it limped through the finish line.
Really?
Yeah.
Why would they put a $2 part in there?
It was a tiny fitting. It wasn't even like, you know, it was something that was inconsequential. The whole thing was like space age.
I mean, they did it space shuttle, right? The O-ring.
It's always the little things, yeah.
You would think they would just manufacture that themselves to make it
They may have done, but they probably thought, well, it could last, you know, one more race or something.
Things fail. Things go wrong. And it was such a one-off. I mean, it was such a unique project. You know, the more you manufacture in bulk, the more serially something is manufactured, the more you can work out the kinks. But it's always like the one-off, you know. It's always like the prototypes or the... There's so many moving parts going on that it's the thing you least expect that's going to be a weak point. And that tiny weak point can bring the whole thing down.
Yeah, when you're driving like around LA, what's a car that just catches your eye when you see it?
It's really hard to catch my eye.
You're like, I've seen these in Italy.
You know, I saw once, and I looked it up later because there's a lot of great cars in LA. Don't get me wrong; like LA has some of the best cars in the world on the roads,
but not like with Monaco, money. Right?
But it's a lot of stuff that you can go out and buy. Stuff, you know, you see a lot of McLarens, Ferraris, Lamborghinis. You know, forget like Range Rovers or dime a dozen. You know,
right.
But I saw what looked like a D-type Jaguar, which is, I mean, they built low double digits of these cars. I think. Very low, like no, it was an XKSS, even rarer. Steve McQueen had one, and I just was flabbergasted. I was like, XKSS, oh my god! I was merging on the 405, and I noted the license plate, and I looked it up, and I found out that it was a replica. I was like, of course, it's a, you know, you can't drive a $12 million car. You can.
Wow.
I mean, I've seen $12 million cars on the road, but you know, it's few and far between.
Right.
So it's really kind of the old, very specific, you know, small batch stuff that you see there. Like, whoa.
So I take it you're not a fan of electric cars, too.
I actually do like electric cars.
What are some of the electric cars that you're a fan of?
I do like electric cars. And it's surprising to me because 16-year-old me would have punched me in the face for saying that.
Well, it's just like, you know, there is an art to that, too, you know, to make it, you know, compete.
Absolutely. You know, the counterintuitive thing is like, if you look at it at face value, you think electric cars are, you know, there's so much to be said for, like, the moving parts of a internal combustion car. So here's a good anecdote. Rolls-Royce, right? They're like a mechanical watch. You know, people love the way the door shuts and the way, you know, it feels and the mechanism, the way you turn the dials and it feels like it was handmade. Rolls-Royce experimented with an electric prototype. And they took it around the world, and they took it to their customers, and they said, what do you think? And the customers basically voted it down because the range actually wasn't there. It wasn't so much that they wanted a mechanical thing. It was that they knew whatever the cruising range of the prototype, it was not a lot. And they said, well, that, you know, it's a nice car, but, you know, the surprising thing about the prototype was it met everything that Rolls-Royce is trying to do. Because you can engineer the switches and the switchgear to feel substantial and expensive, but you know it's quiet, which is what Rolls-Royce is always about. It's seamless. It's even more seamless than a gas car because it doesn't have gears to go through. It just pulls you forward, and it lives up to that Rolls-Royce, the famous waftability term that they invented. You know, wafting is this kind of imaginary word that describes this effortless propulsion. Electricity does it. And it's the funniest thing because, you know, gearheads are usually like, oh, well, forget that. I want a car that makes noise. But, you know, if you're looking for something that pushes you forward and it's smooth and it's refined, I mean, electric cars actually do that.
Yeah.
What was your favorite car to drive?
My favorite car to drive? I'm a little biased. I really like Porsche a lot.
Classic or modern?
The modern cars are phenomenal on a racetrack. GT2 RS, the modern GT2 RS is mind-blowing. It's such a good car, such a good car. And it's a platform that's been evolving for more than 50 years, almost 60 years now. So they keep perfecting it. I personally drive an old Porsche 911 that's air-cooled, a 993. I love driving that because it's got so much personality. It's, you know, a modern minivan could probably beat it 0 to 60, but the experience of driving it is so rewarding.
That's what makes it so important.
It's the sounds, it's the interaction. And part of it for me is, you know, I do drive a lot of modern cars that are pretty damn close to perfect. So when I drive my own car, it's nice to have something that's different. You know, that's part of it too.
Where do you think American engineering is in the world of car manufacturing and engineering?
American engineering is changing quickly. It used to be one thing, like my first car was a Ford Mustang, a 5-liter Mustang, and that was kind of peak America back then. And in a way, you know, the muscle car thing is peak America still. I mean, Dodge Challenger, Hellcat, you know, all those big, big engine muscle cars, Corvette. Like,
yeah, look at the success of the new Mustangs.
Yeah.
The 5-liter, the GTs, everybody buys them.
But
they used to be like in the 50s and 60s, they were up there. And now they're not competing
classic,
on that same level.
But yeah, compared to a modern car, but the modern car is just amazing.
If
you look for like a, you know, fine-tuned machine, it gives you all the fun, all the gadgets, all the you know, the audio systems you have nowadays. It's fun.
American cars are making strides in being relevant in more ways than muscle cars. I mean, the Chevy Bolt was a big step for its time to have an electric car with 238-mile range.
But they stopped manufacturing, right?
Everybody is kind of adapting to this new electric world. Uh-huh. And what's fascinating to me is that Tesla put everyone on alert, because car people love to hate on Tesla, but, you know.
No, I think they're amazing.
The fact that they did what they did at a time when it was not socially acceptable to have an electric car and turned it into a phenomenon has all the big manufacturers chasing them now. So, you know, there's got to be something to be said for that.
Of course.
Whether or not they're around in 5 years, nobody knows, but
they will, because I think if you look at the brains behind it, it's not just building an electrical car that can be cost-effective and cheap to maintain, like a Prius. It's a lot more about it. A lot of it is the technology, the batteries that you can swap out, the power of the engine, the technology inside it, 17-inch screen. I mean, it's more than that. And I think that's what makes them really unique, is that there's a lot of advanced thinking there.
But the world is changing quickly even with that, and I think that they are under a lot of pressure to come out with the next hot thing.
Yeah.
And
I heard it's kind of like
It just looks like X and a Model 3 had a baby, and you know, it was a little underwhelming.
But the 3 is succeeding, no? I mean, they're selling them really well.
I mean, I've heard about a lot of backlog.
Yes.
They did move a lot, but they've got manufacturing issues. They've had
some
a lot of issues with quality control. And it's a tough road. I mean, running a car business is a lot harder than most people realize. And it's probably harder than Elon realized, too. But he's the kind of guy who wants to take risks, and he's continuing to take risks. And, you know, that's... Yeah. That's what he's got to do.
An innovative thinker.
Yeah, they think that, completely. For example, they had their own stores instead of selling them to dealers, right? Their own, and now they're closing it. It's going to.
Well, he said, "I'm going to close all of them," and then he backtracked like a day later and said, "No, I'm going to keep some of them open." So you know,
itself, it was an innovative idea. It just cut the middle, man. All the bullshit of going into a car lot and start dealing with the car salesman and everything.
Yeah, but his problem now, he's just got to cut overhead quickly because the cash flow issue is a thing. So it's a big stakes game, and the gains are big and the losses are big.
Yeah.
So he's got to roll with the punches. And the thing is, I don't know if he would ever sell the company. I mean, there's people who would, you know, there's big car makers who would probably want to swallow it and, you know, use that technology and use the platforms and incorporate it into their own brands. But, you know, I think he wants to do it himself.
Yeah.
But he also wants to go to Mars, so he's distracted. I don't
know. Now, this is a question that either you've researched or you've been able to experience. Who has the coolest car collection that you know of or that you've read about or that you've seen?
I think Ralph Lauren has a stunning collection. He's got exquisite taste, and he likes to drive his stuff too, which I really like.
Like, what cars does he have?
Bugatti Atlantic, one of my favorite cars. He's got a McLaren F1. He's got some cars in pairs because rumor has it that he wants, like, when he's gone, he wants both of his sons not to fight over these cars. So when they inherit the cars, like, two of each. He's got a lot of he's got a lot of textbook supercars, you know, Porsche 918 Spider.
Because you always hear about Jay Leno's collection.
But... Jay Leno has a great collection, and it and what I love about Jay is that it's so eclectic. You know, he's got a room full of French cars and Delahays and gorgeous cars and Duesenbergs, but he's also got a tank-powered one-off that's, you know, jet-powered motorcycle, and, you know, he's got a lot of cool stuff that's all over the map, and that's awesome. And so there's, you know, different philosophies about collecting. Some collectors, like Peter Mullen, has a gorgeous collection. It's all French cars. He's just all about with beautiful French cars. But then you have people like Jay Leno who you just satisfy their curiosity about everything. He's, you know, he loves his Stanley Steamer.
Likes the old cars.
It runs on steam, and he drives it a lot.
Right.
But what's interesting to me, so he's got a Countach or two, and he's got a Mura or two, and he's got, you know, all these poster cars. But what surprised me was that he actually drives a Tesla quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah. I know. Shocker.
That I know Jerry Seinfeld got a big Porsche collection.
Yeah. He's big into Porsche. And yeah. He's been selling a few recently, selling a few off. And there's actually a big controversy over a car that he sold that he's being sued because they said it was a fake.
Ooh.
So it's all in court right now.
How can you fake a Porsche?
You can fake anything, man.
Really? I mean,
yeah, that's kind of odd. And I wouldn't think he would fake a Porsche.
He wouldn't knowingly fake it, I don't think. I mean, why would you? But, you know, there's shady people out there that will sell you things and say that there's something that they're not. It happens in the art world. I mean, there was a Mona Lisa there was a Da Vinci that sold for, I think, $150 million recently that there's controversy over whether it's real or not.
Wow. That's nuts. Two questions. What was your first car? And have you ever fixed up an old car? Like, what's been like your passion project as far as cars?
So my first
car,
motorcycles. Yeah, my first car was I was very lucky, and I'm lucky to be alive. Lucky 16-year-old to have a 5-liter Mustang convertible, manual.
Nice.
I loved that thing when I had it, and you know, it took me across LA. I discovered LA in that car. So I experienced, you know, you know, when you're growing up, you get exposed to a little bit of, you know, radius around where you live. And, you know, every once in a while your parents take you across town. But when you have a car at your own disposal, it opens up the world to you. So that was a great car for me. And it was convertible, which I loved. And, you know.
What year?
88.
Okay.
So that was great when I had it. And it kind of developed my taste for performance. So... it wasn't the most precise machine, but I really got into it.
But it carried you through your adolescence.
Indeed, indeed. So apart from doing really minor maintenance, like oil changes and stuff, like I changed the oil in that car, but I stopped doing that the busier I got and the more I was doing things, you know, for work. And I always loved the way cars worked, and I always wanted to work on cars. And I never really got my hands totally dirty until I got that old Land Rover. And I started doing a few things here and there with the guidance of some friends helping me out on the internet. And I haven't, you know, it's not like I've ripped apart the whole engine on that, but I've done a few things here and there, you know, replaced the fuel pump, taken things apart, and problem solved stuff. And it's such a simple car that
you can actually tackle this.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Bassam and I, we met in line getting concert tickets, okay? And we just hit it off talking about music. I know you're a huge Sting fan like I am.
Yep, yep.
And we started talking about Sting and Dave Matthews Band and all the bands that we both love. And then, you know, we exchanged emails, and I was like, I see his name is Wasef. I'm like, you don't know Sherry Wasef. He's like, dude, that's my sister. I'm like, I've been singing with your sister since I was a little kid, man. So both he and his sister have come to our House of Blues shows, and he's just been an amazing cat. And
so whoever tells you that L.A. is a big city – is
not
it's
right
not.
Yes
totally.
So, and you know what, you started doing a lot of film stuff. You were doing music videos, mm-hmm. and then you started incorporating your two loves. Tell us a little bit about that. Like, you did cars and you were directing stuff for car companies. Tell us about
so I've always had a passion for the visual as well, and it's always gone hand in hand with the mechanical thing, but fresh out of college, you know, and still photography as well. My wife is doing the little, don't forget the photography, because it all goes back to that.
Good promoter, that's right.
Oh, it all goes
It's all connected.
I was the kid in high school who would spend hours in the photo lab developing and printing stuff in black and white. And that's kind of like, that was like the bedrock for my visual formation, you know, like, you know, photography magazines and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. So graduating from high school into college, I went to UCLA, started taking film classes.
No one's perfect.
USC.
That's right.
That's another topic for another time. Film classes, and I totally derailed my career path. I ended up working at Disney ABC Cable Networks for 8 years, and I was an executive doing music programming and TV and reality shows.
Wow.
And I did that for quite a while, and I got so into it, and I started directing music videos and producing my own stuff. And the car thing ended up really being a diversion from that, because I never thought I'd do it professionally, but there was a magazine that was looking for somebody who could write about cars. And I was like, oh, I'll just do it on the side, you know. And before I knew it, it was taking over everything. So I was doing that. And, you know, it's funny how when you let yourself fall into these things, the doors start to open up. So, like, a few years ago, I started consulting for an aircraft company, Icon Aircraft, and helping with them with marketing communications. And a lot of their stuff was visual. So I was shooting photos for them, and then I was hiring photographers for them. I was directing little videos for them, and then we were hiring production companies for them. And I just kept going into it, and I did stuff for automotive later, too.
You have that attention to detail, too, because I don't think you can be a fan of, like, people that craft things, engineering, crafting, creating stuff with that attention to detail and not also strive for that in your own creations.
I do start from the detail and build upon that, and that's why I love the short form mediums. I mean, that's why directors like David Fincher and Stanley Kubrick always capture my imagination, because they start like with the little thing and build it out. They don't, you know, I mean, they tell big stories, but every little thing
it grows,
is modulated.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And it's a great thing, but it's also an affliction, too. You obsess over this stuff, you know? It's like music, right?
Right, it is. There are very similar parallels. That's the thing that drives me crazy. You can go down the rabbit hole very easily.
Mm-hmm.
So it started with you just doing something on the side, and then it just took over. And now you're writing books on it. You're doing...
Mm-hmm.
Is there another book in the works? Or are you just going to take a long break from writing?
I only have so many books in me within a certain amount of time because it's so consuming.
How long does each book take you to write?
So I usually do it alongside my other work. I can't just shut everything off and work on a book. So, I mean, this one is probably about, I don't know, 10 months maybe.
That's a long time.
But it's, and it's a lot of, like, little bits here and there, you know, like staying up late one night and then, like, staying up late in a couple nights and doing, you know, filling it in. But my mind works well like that for some reason, and I like to jump from thing to thing because then it keeps it fresh. And the things...
I feel like the editing process is the hardest when you finish and you have to go back and kind of with a fine-tooth comb figure out what things to kind of take out, what things to leave to kind of make it.
It is.
Formulate, you know, one single vision.
And the more you build a body of work, I find the harder it is. You know, you're harder on yourself because you know your voice, you know what you want it to be. And I kind of miss, like, when I started writing for the first time, I would just blurt it all out, and then I'd, like, read it over, and I'd be like, you know, well, this is pretty good, you know? But the more you do it, the more you fine-tooth comb, and then the harder you are on yourself, and then you start, you know, doubting yourself, and it becomes like a bigger process.
Yeah, there has to be a point in the middle of the book where you're like, I don't even know if I want to finish this thing, you know? And then you kind of like storm through it, you know? You weather the storm, and you just kind of one foot in front of the other.
Exactly.
Keep marching forward. You know?
Exactly. A hero of mine is in the book world is Randy Leffingwell, and
I don't know him.
He is one of the most. He does a lot of transportation books, and he was basically like the publishing house that did my book. He's like their most successful author.
Wow, that's awesome.
And photographer, and he does both. And you know, I was asking him for advice. He was kind of my mentor on my first project, and. I was like, this is a lot of, like, how do I... He's like, you know what? It's a lot like eating an elephant. And you start with one bite.
What was the first car that you started writing about?
The first car, gosh, it wasn't really about the order. You mean, like,
Yeah, for your, any of the books, you know what I mean? Because it usually, it's like what you said, it does start with one single step, you know what I mean?
Well, I'll tell you the first writing assignment that I had for automotive. So a small lifestyle magazine in L.A. that's no longer around called Brentwood Magazine. My first assignment was to write about convertibles for their summer issue.
Hmm.
And this is my first thing ever. So, like, I cold called all the manufacturers I wanted to work with. And before I knew it, I had an Aston Martin DB7 Volante my garage, Porsche 911 Cabriolet in my garage, Maserati Spyder in my garage, and a AMG Mercedes in my garage.
Wow.
And my neighbors thought I was a drug dealer.
Like, what do you do again?
Yeah. They're like, what? What is going on
So these
here?
Car companies just sent you the cars and said, have at it.
They basically said, oh, yeah, we know that magazine. Yeah. Sure. Here, just so they do this. They give you a car for a certain amount of time. It's usually a week, and you experience it. And this is when you're at home. So if I'm writing about a car at a racetrack, it's a big organized press junket where they curate this experience for you to drive the car at a racetrack and drive it on public roads and interview the engineers and talk to race car drivers. And it's a thing. But that first experience was like a real eye opener. It was like, whoa. And you're living life through somebody else's eyes, basically. You're driving these cars that you can't afford.
Right.
And it's like, you know, oh, this is what it's like. Okay. And
then, like, oh, this is what the 1%, this is what they experience.
And then you start to realize, you know what? There's things that I don't like about this, you know? And that's the other revelation. Well, what I learned doing this, I've been doing this for over 15 years now. What I learned is that the dollar amount is not directly proportional to the experience.
Hmm.
And you asked me early on about motorcycles, and that's what I go back to in my head is, like, sometimes I'm riding a $15,000 Triumph and I get a bigger thrill than I do a $250,000 Ferrari because it's just a different experience.
Right.
You know? A car is limited. You're limited by your surroundings. You're limited by how many cars there are on the road, you know? I mean, it's the great equalizer. You're driving down the 405 in a $1 million car, and there's a guy in a $500 car next to you that could be going faster than you.
Right, right. Which is often the case.
Often the case. Damn, I picked the wrong lane again.
Just natural. Do you find that cars coming into the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you know, do you think they're going to be as innovative, more competitive, or less competitive? Because you see this age of Uber and Lyft. I mean, there are a lot of millennials don't even have cars, which to me, I'm like, I never thought that would ever be an option because it's so empowering to have a car. But now it's becoming the opposite. It's like more of a burden and a privilege that you don't need to spend the money on. You know what I mean?
The role of the car is changing dramatically. And it would be easy. It would almost be too easy to say that it's going to continue to happen exponentially. It would if there were no governmental interventions or no limitations on what you could do. I think you'd find car companies going to extreme lengths to embrace the future. For better or worse, and I think it's better, governmental regulations will hopefully keep everybody safe, and that's the most important thing. Because I've been in situations with semi-autonomous cars where I've been caught off guard and they don't do what I think they're going to do. They don't stay in the lane or they don't brake quickly enough and I have to intervene. And if I'm the limiting factor, you know, I want the car to not pretend like it can do things that it can't do.
Yeah.
I have a lot of friends who are looking forward to not having to drive a car and be in a car that is driving itself. And that's great and that's cool. But think about where those people are right now. They're driving cars on the road. So you've got to be super careful out there.
I mean, especially in a city like L.A., I'd love a car that I would just go in, you know, push a button, say, take me to work, and I just pull the seat back, and that's it. I don't have to deal with the actual driving.
Right.
But on the other hand, yes, I'd love that exciting car, the motorcycle, so that I can take on the weekend, especially in California with the weather that we have here, to take on the weekend and have fun with it.
There's something about driving or just open
the
road.
The commute here is so long and so exhausting.
It saps the life out of you.
Yeah.
It takes the joy out of the thing that we
exactly.
love.
Right. Because you spend so much in traffic. So sometimes you just say, you know what, let the car drive itself. But maybe with autonomous cars and the ride sharing, that will be probably the... I think I read an article about it. Say that, eventually... In like 15, 20 years, maybe we won't own cars. We'll just do the ride sharing, autonomous cars.
Which is crazy. It's crazy to think about.
If you look at it abstractly, though, it's fascinating because, you know, the benefits, they're not readily visible, but you think about it, you know, they could theoretically take fatalities to zero if everybody's on the same page.
Right.
All of these cars are driving themselves and talking to each other.
Right.
Eliminate fatalities. Like,
right.
Exactly. Okay, that's huge.
No more the accordion effect.
Right.
They're all driving the same speed.
The man hours of people who you can do other things.
It's no like, more distracted
that, well, that's
driving.
The big thing is the efficiency of being able to do something else instead of having to drive.
And that's why I love Uber and Lyft right now. Is like, I love driving, but if I've got to get somewhere and it's going to take me an hour and a half in L.A. to get from opposite ends of the city,
you wasted
I could
so
be
much
on my
time.
Laptop getting stuff
right.
done.
Right.
It's like I don't need to, you know, be driving for that. That's no fun.
I got two more questions. You ready?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
First, favorite era Batmobile. Hey, that's an important question.
OG.
Okay.
Very first.
I like it.
Oh, yeah.
Very good question.
Barris,
good
yeah.
answer.
Absolutely.
The very first, what was it?
The 70s,
Lincoln?
Right?
Oh, yeah.
The Lincoln?
It's the one.
It's iconic.
Yeah.
It's iconic. I like the, you know, the one, the Tim Burton version, the first.
Uh-huh.
That was a Stingray, I think.
Who knows?
It was weird when it went to an SUV, but I just had to ask that because,
what,
you're
talking
you know,
about
like,
the version with Michael Keaton,
yeah,
the first one?
Yeah,
yeah. With Jack Nicholson?
Yeah, I had that poster up on my wall.
Mm-hmm.
I remember. I think it was an old Stingray that
mm-hmm.
they modified. Yeah.
So what was it about that?
It was the shape.
Mm-hmm.
It was just sexy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I've been watching the 70s Batman shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that version. And never would I ever have imagined that to be a Batmobile.
Uh-huh.
And now you see the new ones, you know, Christopher Nolan ones. And you wouldn't think an SUV would be a Batmobile.
Yeah, it's kind of
that was a big
going
leap.
Against
it's like
time.
A Humvee, yeah.
Yep.
Where can people find your books and you if they want you to A, write something for their automotive magazine, or B, where can they purchase your book?
Amazon. It's all online now. The Everything Store. And Instagram is my favorite medium of
What's
the
your Instagram handle?
Bassem Wassef, my name. Yeah.
Spell it out because people are dumb.
Bassemwasef.
It's the easiest.
Catchy, family. Isn't it?
Yeah, the show will be up soon on the show page on LA Talk Radio, so I'll have the link to your Instagram.
Great,
as well.
Thank
awesome.
You.
Awesome. I've been waiting so long to interview you, man.
So good
you
to see you.
You released this book maybe 4 or 5 months ago.
Been around a little while, yeah.
Something like that, right?
Yeah.
So I've been wanting to interview you since then.
It was just in time for the holidays last.
Worked. That's right.
2018, but yeah.
Well, we hope to see you write many more. I don't believe that there's a finite amount of books in you. I think you're going to write a lot more.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the automotive age is changing, and we need more information.
There's
so.
Always stuff to talk about.
So you're going to have to come back for your next book. All
right? Will do.
It's a promise.
Would love to.
Seal it with the fist. All right,
boom.
Fist bump. On behalf of Ronan and myself, we'll see you guys here next week.
Woo!